Welcome to ACE Podcasts. Thanks for tuning in as we elevate clinical endocrinology by taking deep dives into trends and topics that can help us improve our patient care and global health. Find the latest episodes on aace.com/podcasts. And now, let's meet the endocrine experts who will be talking with us today.
Welcome, everybody, to the ACE podcast. My name is David Lieb. I am an endocrinologist and fellowship director at Eastern Virginia Medical School in Norfolk, Virginia. I am also proud to be the Education Oversight Committee Chair for ACE. And I am especially proud to host our podcast with our plenary speakers. So thank you so much for joining us. We're going to have a great discussion with three fantastic preeminent endocrinologists who are going to be providing plenary lectures at the annual meeting this May in Seattle. I think you'll learn about thyroid disease, diabetes, and adrenal disease. And I look forward to seeing all of you there. So it is my pleasure to talk with my friend and colleague, Dr. Elizabeth Pierce. Dr. Pierce is a professor of medicine and the Endocrinology Fellowship Program Director at Boston University School of Medicine in the section of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Nutrition. She received her undergraduate medical degrees from Harvard Medical School and a master's degree in epidemiology from the Boston University School of Public Health. Elizabeth was president of the American Thyroid Association from 2018 to 2019 and has served as the regional coordinator for North America for the Iodine Global Network. She's a deputy editor for the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, and chaired the 2017 American Thyroid Association Thyroid and Pregnancy Guidelines Task Force, and is a member of the current task force for revising that guideline. Elizabeth, your research interests include the sufficiency of dietary iodine in the U.S., thyroid function in pregnancy, and the thyroid effects of environmental perchlorate exposure. And you were the recipient of the 2011 American Thyroid Association Van Meter Award for Outstanding Contributions to Research on the Thyroid Gland, and the 2018 Women in Thyroidology Woman of the Year Award. You were also chair of our ACE 2021 annual meeting. So I am very excited to talk with you today, and I'm looking forward to your talk at our annual meeting this year in Seattle. You're going to talk about endocrine disruptors and thyroid health. How did you become interested in that topic?
Through my mentor, Lou Braverman, who was a truly amazing thyroidologist and an amazing person, but he had been engaged in work on iodine nutrition for many years before I met him, and had been working on perchlorate as kind of the first of the thyroidal disruptors that I worked on. So I started as a fellow working with Lou.
So you've been working in this area for a long time.
I'm getting old.
No. I think we are all getting older. And when I think about iodine, I think about the importance of iodine in the diet and in pregnancy. But a number of the folks that I take care of in the endocrine clinic that are not pregnant also have lots of questions about iodine. So what sorts of recommendations do you give to your patients about iodine in their diet when they have thyroid disease?
So iodine deficiency was eliminated in the U.S. by and large almost 100 years ago. We iodized salt in the U.S. in 1924, and we're coming up on the centennial. Jeez. And so we haven't really thought a whole lot about iodine deficiency in this country for a really long time. But unfortunately, we're seeing a reemergence of mild to moderate iodine deficiency, probably especially in pregnant women in the U.S., and maybe in people who follow very restricted diets, for example, people who are lactose intolerant or follow vegan diets, because probably one of the major contributors to dietary iodine in this country now is dairy foods, and not everybody ingests dairy. So I think from a clinical perspective, we don't have an individual biomarker for iodine. We can't really diagnose iodine deficiency in individual patients, but we can counsel all of our patients that if they're going to add salt to food, make sure it's iodized salt. And if they are pregnant, planning pregnancy, or breastfeeding, should take a daily supplement that contains 150 micrograms of iodine, just because that nutrient is so important for thyroid hormone, and especially for brain development in utero and early life.
So it sounds like it's important to get a dietary history from all of our patients that we treat for thyroid disease.
I have to admit, I don't always. much as I think iodine nutrition is really important, because I think by and large, practicing in the United States, for most of our patients, the iodine is not going to be an issue. But I certainly do want to know if people practice a vegan diet. I do want to know if they're, you know, planning pregnancy, because those are patients I would definitely counsel about supplementation.
Okay. And globally, what does the picture look like in other parts of the world?
Globally, the picture is much, much better than 30 years ago, but we're not there yet. So there are still a lot of parts of the world where we see mild to moderate iodine deficiency, especially in pregnancy. And this is not kind of related to resources that, you know, Western Europe, Australia, they're high resource parts of the world where we're still seeing iodine deficiencies. And what we know over the last decade is that even fairly mild iodine deficiency in pregnant women may impact child IQ.
Ah, okay. And I know I'll often see folks that read about something on the internet or hear about iodine supplementation when they are already iodine sufficient. Are there harms to taking iodine or iodine in high doses when you don't necessarily need it?
Absolutely. Yeah. As for most nutrients, too little is not good, but too much is not good either. There's a U-shaped relationship, and you're more likely to be hypothyroid with too little iodine or with too much. So exceeding 1,000 milligrams a day outside pregnancy or 500 micrograms outside pregnancy or 500 in pregnancy or lactation may actually increase risk for hypothyroidism and is not advised.
Yeah, I've seen that happen here and there in my clinical practice. And you know, I think people are hoping that iodine has a lot of healthy benefits to it. There's a lot of information out there, but there is some potential harm. So I'm glad that you brought that up and we talked about it.
And in fact, sometimes when my patients ask, what can they do from kind of a lifestyle perspective to improve hypothyroidism? The sad answer is we don't really have a lot that is evidence-based that they can really do in terms of diet or lifestyle or supplements. But the one thing I tell them is absolutely unequivocally stay away from any supplement that's marketed for thyroid health. A lot of them contain enormous amounts of iodine that's really not healthy. And some of them illegally contain thyroid hormone.
Yes, yes, yes. Do you have an approach to evaluating for supplement use in patients that you see in clinic? Because I know a lot of people take different types of supplements and some of them can be harmful.
Yeah. And, you know, with regard specifically to the thyroid, I particularly want to know, are they taking any of those supplements labeled for thyroid health? Those make me nervous. I want to know if they're taking enormous doses of iodine. Occasionally we see those patients who are. And I really want to know if they're taking biotin, if I'm evaluating for thyroid dysfunction. So I do ask pretty consistently about those things. And in my patients who are planning pregnancy, pregnant, lactating, I ask about whether they're taking a prenatal vitamin that specifically has iodine in it.
Awesome. Can you talk a little bit more about biotin? Because I feel like when medical students, residents, and fellows rotate with me, if I can teach them one thing before they leave the endocrine rotation, I want to make sure that they've heard about biotin.
Yeah. So in some assays, this is not true for all automated assay platforms, but in some assays that are bioattenolated assays, people with completely normal thyroid function can look biochemically exactly like they have Graves' disease. TSH will be low, peripheral thyroid hormone will be high, and the thyroid stimulating immunoglobulin may be elevated. And that is all spurious. It is all artifact. And so important when somebody has a new diagnosis and you don't know if the laboratory where they had labs measured uses bioattenolated assays, or if you know your own lab, you know, does. It's really important to get that history. And if there's any question, if the clinical picture doesn't seem to fit the biochemical picture, for example, you know, important to repeat labs when people have been holding that supplement for, you know, about 3 days, just to make sure you're seeing adequate, accurate results.
It's pretty common. Once I started asking people if they took biotin or if they were taking a supplement to help with their hair growth or nail strength, a lot of people take it.
Absolutely. And this is one I think that is well worth asking about because you can really go down the wrong pathway if you believe labs you shouldn't believe.
For sure. So thyroid hormone is very special. It doesn't like to be taken with food. It doesn't like to be taken with other medications. I know folks have questions about when to take their thyroid hormone, how to take it, if they need to take it in the morning, if they should take it at night. What do you recommend to your patients?
So studies have shown that you can take it, you know, fasting before breakfast, you can take it at bedtime, it's fine. And honestly, I sometimes have patients who are so committed to doing it absolutely right that if they've eaten, you know, they just won't take their thyroid hormone that day, which is really not helpful at all. So I think the key thing is for people to actually ingest it. And, you know, if they had breakfast, if they forgot, just take it. If they forgot yesterday's pill to take two the next day, it's fine. It's forgiving. So I do think it's important. It will be better absorbed and more consistently absorbed if people do it on an empty stomach and don't eat anything for 30 minutes. But honestly, I think the key message for my patients is please, you know, just take the pills and we'll adjust the TSH accordingly.
I like that it's special and people sometimes are setting alarms to take it before their other meds or getting up, you know, earlier to do it. But it is forgiving because of its long half-life. So I like that. One of the things that I've seen some nice studies recently in the literature involves when to potentially stop somebody's thyroid hormone. So we see folks that are sometimes started on thyroid hormone. It's not entirely clear why or what the indication was or what was going on at the time. When might you consider holding thyroid hormone and seeing if somebody still needs it?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the literature really suggests that a lot of patients have been started on levothyroxine for maybe kind of marginal indications. Maybe it was a thyroiditis that resolved. Maybe it was very marginal subclinical hypothyroidism, and there maybe truly isn't a benefit. And we do worry about polypharmacy, especially in our older patients. So, you know, if there's a way to eliminate a medication that's not needed, it's always worth thinking about. Having said that, if somebody has a thyroidectomy scar, you know, if somebody clearly does not have thyroid function, one should not attempt this. But when the initial story is unclear, and, you know, the patient is kind of willing to try this as an experiment, if somebody's on kind of a full replacement dose, I think one needs to do it gradually. I don't think you take thyroid hormone away and just wait, you know, 2 months to see if they crash. But one can taper gradually. If the TSH doesn't bump up, you can keep tapering them down. And if somebody's on a very low dose, 25 micrograms or 50 micrograms, I think it's reasonable to just stop, you know, if you don't have sort of clear knowledge that they truly need to be on it, and just establish definitively, do they need this or not?
Yeah, I especially worry sometimes my older patients who are on so many other medications, and I see that they're taking a very tiny dose of thyroid hormone, and sometimes they wonder if they still need to take it. And so that's helpful to think about holding it and kind of watching them closely and seeing how they do.
All right. And a 25 microgram dose, you know, so anybody comes in on that, I usually assume it's kind of homeopathic and there may be a placebo effect, but I assume there's often good reason to assume that they may not actually need that.
Right. I wanted to ask one more question. Generally, when I have questions about thyroid disease, I reach out to you, but certainly in pregnancy, you're my go-to person for asking for help. What advice or recommendations do you have for folks that are coming to the meeting that may be in primary care, or maybe obstetricians or endocrinologists? What kind of multidisciplinary care is important for the pregnant individual with thyroid disease?
I think handoffs are incredibly important for the setting, because often it's not the endocrinologists for the vast majority of people with thyroid disease who are going to become pregnant, particularly hypothyroid patients. And so preconception counseling, making sure that the patient knows that they may need more close monitoring in the pregnancy setting, that may need to start immediately as soon as they know they're pregnant. That's specifically true in hypothyroid patients where they may not have an endocrinologist. And so I think preconception counseling for anybody who's prescribing thyroid hormone or antithyroid drug, have that conversation ideally before the patient walks in and says, my pregnancy test was positive 3 weeks ago. So you have a game plan, and making sure everybody kind of understands, you know, the importance of this monitoring, and that the patient is not getting conflicting advice from, you know, six different places. So often good to just make sure you're sort of communicating with other team members.
This is one of those areas, the reasons that I really enjoy endocrinology is that it's a multidisciplinary specialty for sure. And so I always enjoy getting to know the other folks at my institution that take care of our patients so we can really take care of folks from a team approach. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining me for some conversation about iodine and thyroid disease, certainly something very common that we all see in clinic. I see most days that I'm in clinic. And I know we're very excited for your presentation on Friday, May 5th. You're going to be talking about endocrine disruptors and thyroid health. And then you'll be available afterwards for a deep dive for folks that want to come and get to know you a little bit better and ask you some more questions about thyroid disease.
I'm really looking forward to seeing everybody in Seattle.
Awesome. Thank you so much to Dr. Pieris. I know we're all looking forward to her presentation at the annual meeting. Now we're going to shift from thinking about the thyroid to another condition that is near and dear to my heart, diabetes. I'm very excited to talk today with Dr. Earl Hirsch. Dr. Hirsch is professor of medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine. And from both a research and a teaching point of view, his career is focused on studying the best strategies for the use of insulin therapy in both individuals with type 1 and also type 2 diabetes. More recently, he's become interested in glycemic data management, and we'll talk about that, and its relationship to more traditional diabetes biomarkers. Over the years, Dr. Hirsch has been a passionate advocate for patients, ensuring access and affordability for insulin and for glucose monitoring technology, and I can't say enough about that. He's participated in numerous international consensus guideline committees, including those for diabetes technology, inpatient hyperglycemia, type 1 diabetes, hyperglycemic emergencies, and precision medicine in diabetes. So Dr. Hirsch, thank you so much for being here to talk a little bit before your plenary.
Sure. Thanks, David. Good to be here.
Thank you. And I'm excited about the topic of your plenary, the past, present, and future of insulin therapy and related controversies. That's going to be on Friday, May 5th. And then afterwards, for folks that are listening to the podcast, after the plenary, there's going to be a session where folks have a chance to meet with you and kind of do a deeper dive. So I guess we can start by talking about insulin. You know, every time I look in our sample refrigerator at work, there seems to be a new insulin. I remember when I was first treated for my type 1 diabetes, it was regular and Lente. Lente is now gone. And now they're rapid acting analogs and even longer basal insulins. Where do you see the future of insulin preparations? What's coming down the road?
Well, you're right. The explosion from the protein chemists has been impressive. In fact, when insulin lispro or Humalog was introduced in 1996, I was told by somebody at Eli Lilly, we'll never get it faster than this. This is as good as it's ever going to get. And of course, that was wrong. We were told a lot of things that were wrong because we didn't have the CGM to actually tell us the way they did the label, you know, giving the insulin right when you ate, or if you remember with Apidra, giving the insulin after you ate. Well, it all depends on how you look at the data. So we have come a long way since our first analogs and even further since the animal insulin days, which yeah. It sounds like you remember that very well.
Yes.
And what the real question is, what's next? Well, I do believe we are, for the non-pump patients, I do believe we are going to be using more pulmonary inhaled insulin. A lot of people forget about that, but it's really an amazing insulin that has not had the uptake that I think it should or could, and a lot of reasons for that. But I believe we're going to see more of that used in the next few years, and a lot of reasons for that. I also think that we will be seeing sooner than later, and all the studies have been published, at weekly insulins. That's going to happen. But the question is, what about the next step? We get these insulins that are a week long. We now have insulins that are in and out in 90 minutes. They're so fast. What we would really like, and what I would really like, is a smart insulin. What would happen if you gave an injection once a week where there was a little nanosensor on the insulin particle that would increase the insulin amount or decrease it based on the glucose in the blood? How cool would that be? Do I think that could happen? Do I think we have the engineers who could do that? The answer is absolutely yes, because I've talked to them. Do I think we will ever see that? The answer is absolutely no. And it all comes back to the whole issue of cost. Even in the old days being a year ago, when before we had insulin caps on CMS, and now we have all these insulins from all three of the insulin companies just within the last week that are going to make the insulin very affordable and accessible, which, by the way, is a good thing.
Yes.
Sort of the downstream effect from that is big innovations in insulin, like a smart insulin. I just don't see a business model for that happening.
Yeah. No, I've followed some of that literature over time. And again, as somebody living with type 1 diabetes, I've always been very excited about some of those smart insulins. But I won't tell you where I was in my life in 1996, but I do remember when I got my first vial of Humalog, Lispro, changing over from regular. So things have definitely come a long way. And from a technology standpoint, I mean, there's just been such a boom in continuous glucose monitoring. And I feel like when I'm talking to patients in clinic, for those that are able to afford and use a CGM, the A1C isn't as important to me as it used to be. And I wanted to ask for your thoughts about CGM versus A1C and kind of how you use those different markers of glycemic control in your practice.
Well, we all learned during the pandemic that the GMI, the glycemic management indicator, we can use instead of A1C just fine. And you can make an argument, well, now you're using the actual glucose instead of a biomarker. Maybe this is a better thing to do in clinical medicine. The problem is many of the insurances don't accept it yet. And for that matter, the regulatory agencies around the world, here in the US, FDA, does not accept that as a study outcome, at least not yet. But I would argue there are even more important, I don't want to say esoteric parts, but things that the clinical endocrinologist needs to know. Point number one, we published a study 2 years ago looking at 641 of our type 1 patients here in Seattle. And we didn't pick them because they didn't have anemia or kidney disease or liver disease or ethnicity, although obviously here in Seattle, type 1 diabetes is mostly a white disease. Nevertheless, we looked and compared the GMI to the A1C. And what we found is that if you look at the GMI of 7%, which would be a mean glucose of 154, which is the target from all the organizations, I guess with ACE, we still want it below 6.5, whole other story, but the lower the better without hypoglycemia. I think everybody agrees with that. But this is what we found, David. We found first that 50% of the population, 641 people, the A1C GMI discordance was more than 0.5%. So if you had a GMI of 7.0, your A1C measured from the University of Washington lab was either more than 7.5 or less than 6.5 in 50%. And what we also found is that in 22% of the population, that ratio, in 22% of the population, that delta discordance was 1%. So what that means is that if your GMI is 7%, what that means is that in 22% of the population, the measured A1C was over 8 or less than 6, because that's 1% from 7. So let's think about that for a moment. For somebody who's doing finger sticks with type 1, or maybe somebody doing little to no finger sticks with type 2, we make a decision based on that A1C number to add a drug, to subtract a drug, to make a diagnosis of diabetes. We make that decision if it's to tell a woman it's safe to get pregnant.
Yep.
We even use that number to tell a doctor if he's doing a good job with his patients with diabetes or any individual patient in particular. I mean, we know from Rich Bergenstahl and Roy Beck's study that on average, African-Americans read 0.4 to 0.5% higher for any given glucose compared to a Caucasian population. Why are we using this number? Why is this number so entrenched for us, for our patients, for the payers? It's wrong.
Yeah, it's wrong.
And my final comment, just to give you a little bit of interest, we actually then thought, is there any reason to look at this ratio, the GMI and the A1C, to predict complications? Because all the A1C is glycation of glucose to a protein. Can we predict complications looking at the two together? Does it have any biological impact so that if you are somewhere in rural Virginia or North Carolina or New York or anywhere in the United States or the world, and you have a patient comes in with a high A1C and a low GMI, what does that mean for their risk of retinopathy and diabetic kidney disease? And all I can tell you is hang on to your hats, because later this year, you're going to find out.
Well, I love it. Yeah. Thanks for the shout out to rural Virginia too, because that's in my backyard. That's not too far away from where I am. And a lot of the people that we take care of in Norfolk come from very rural areas here. Excellent. Any comments on point of care A1C? Because I feel that in order to meet some of those benchmarks that we're supposed to meet clinically, and I'm sure, you know, a number of the folks in primary care, you know, that are listening to this also, You know, we have to have an A1C every so often. So a lot of people have moved to point of care. Any concerns with accuracy and with that test versus a blood draw, a venous blood draw?
Yeah, the point of care in the laboratory or the physician's office, they're okay. They struggle a little bit near the normal ranges and the low ranges of A1C. They do better as they come back. From my point of view, if it's 0.2, 0.3, 0.4 off, it doesn't matter. It doesn't really change anything. To me, what's important is the time in range, the time below range, and the GMI. And so the CGM is much more important than that number. I do the number because I have to do the number. Otherwise, because almost all of my patients are on CGM.
Yeah.
Now, for your patients who don't use CGM, and maybe you're a primary care provider that only sees type 2 patients, and there are a lot of primary care providers in the country like that, and maybe the patient can't afford a CGM or you're not familiar enough, it is still my opinion you need to do one CGM on them, a professional CGM, whether it's blinded or not. And the reason is you want to see if there is discordance or concordance between the CGM and the GMI. Because if you're a point off, you can't use the A1C to make treatment decisions in these type 2 patients. You want to make sure that the A1C is concordant with the CGM GMI. Otherwise, I think you're wasting your time.
You know, you brought up affordability, and what can we do as practitioners that take care of people with endocrine disease and diabetes? What can we do to advocate for our patients to get some of these things covered that aren't covered now?
Yeah, it's really tough here in Washington State. Over the years, there have been two times I have testified to the decision makers in Olympia, Washington, which is our state capital, to get things covered. We do a bit better here than in some states. I don't know if Medicare is a Medicaid expansion state or not, but that makes a big deal in the past, both for insulin affordability and for CGM use. That to me is the number one thing. This is so difficult to do if you don't have Medicaid expansion. For the insurance coverage people, it's letter writing, it's phone calls. You just shake your head when you have a patient, and I've had many of these over the years, an episode of severe hypoglycemia, and they couldn't afford a CGM. That just shouldn't happen in 2023.
Yep. Yeah, we were fortunate here in Virginia, Medicaid expanded, I think 2018, 2019, but I know that's not the case everywhere. Well, kind of thinking more about the future, I like how much of our conversation is about the present, but also the future. What are some of the exciting things that you see happening in diabetes care in the next 5 years?
I think we need to break that down into type 1 and type 2. In the type 2, I think the explosion of the GLP-1s and the GLP-1 GIPs, and there will be more than what we have now. And what that is going to do, not just for people with type 2 diabetes on insulin, not just for obesity, but we can look all the way down to the pre-diabetes bucket of people and potentially have a situation where, again, can we afford it? Can we afford to put these people with pre-diabetes on these medications? I certainly do think that using these drugs for obesity is great, but the problem is such poor coverage around the country. And what we really need is we need better coverage for obesity, and we need better studies, more studies using these newer weekly drugs in prediabetes. So I think that's in the type 2. These drugs are revolutionizing type 2 diabetes right now. And I think both you and I see this every day in our clinic for those people who have access to it. In the type 1 world, I do think, by the way, because there are studies that are going to be starting soon, I do think we are going to see GLP-1s in type 1 diabetes. A letter came out this month in Annals of Internal Medicine showing the horrible obesity we see in the United States with type 1 diabetes. We know that's an issue. We know it has additional cardiovascular risk. I do think in the next 5 years, we're going to have even more penetration of CGM and automated insulin delivery. But if I was going to say the single thing that I am looking forward to in the next 5 years in type 1 diabetes, and this would also include type 2 diabetes. It's not more immunomodulators for preclinical type 1, although I'm very excited about that. It's non-invasive glucose monitoring. And I'm not sure which company is going to do it, but it's going to happen. And I'll tell you what, I'll buy you a cup of Seattle coffee in any city in the country, because you can get Seattle coffee in any city in the country, almost any city in the world, actually.
Yeah.
And I have many patients who work for that particular company. But I am pretty convinced that somebody within the next 5 years is going to have a non-invasive glucose monitor that will not just be used on a smartwatch for health, a health watch, but will be used for insulin management.
Yeah, I share that hope. And I don't think I'm going to take up that bet because I want to see it happen too. Well, Dr. Hirsch, this has been a real pleasure to get to talk with you. We're very excited to come to your city and hear you speak at the ACE meeting. And I can't thank you enough. Thank you for a great discussion.
Yeah, thanks for having me, David.
Thank you so much again, Dr. Hirsch, for all of your insight and answering such great questions. Now we're going to shift to yet another very important endocrine gland. We're going to talk about the adrenal. And I'm very excited to have a wonderful expert here with us today, Dr. Richard Aukus. Dr. Aukus is professor of internal medicine in the Division of Metabolism, Endocrinology, and Diabetes at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He serves as chief of the endocrinology section at the Veterans Administration Ann Arbor Healthcare System. Dr. Aukus and his group are active in research projects ranging from basic chemical principles of steroid biosynthetic enzymes and steroid mass spectrometry to clinical trials and translational investigation in disorders of the pituitary, adrenal, ovaries, and testes that cause common conditions, hypertension, infertility, and obesity. And Dr. Aukus is going to be joining us for a plenary session on Thursday, May 4th, talking about management of adrenal gland hypertension. And then we'll be available after for a post-plenary deeper dive. And then is also presenting again on Friday in the afternoon and is going to talk about the management of individuals with congenital adrenal hyperplasia. So thank you so much, Dr. Aukus, for joining us.
Thank you, David. It's great to be here with you today.
Thank you. So I thought we'd start with a question that a number of folks were interested in. I feel like we're seeing an increased momentum for screening for hyperaldosteronism or primary aldosteronism. And I wanted to ask your thoughts about who we need to be screening, because I think it's a lot of people.
Right. So I think screening should be a low threshold for primary aldosteronism for a couple of reasons. One is, yes, it's actually quite common. It's probably about 8% of all people with hypertension. In Japan, they screen everybody with hypertension for primary aldosteronism. Now, I wouldn't quite go that far, but I think you should have a low threshold because we have targeted treatments that are cheap and widely available for this. So what I'd like to emphasize about that is I think people are paralyzed about screening because they think they have to stop all these medicines and they think they have to go the whole nine yards if they do the screening test. But what I want to do is, in my talk, is to try to make it simple for people, that you have a couple of decision trees about how far you go in the evaluation based on how much the patient might benefit if you find a tumor. And if you don't, then it doesn't matter whether they have it or don't have it or meet this criteria or that criteria, because you can just treat them medically. So I'll go over that in detail and try to make your life a lot easier and hopefully take better care of your patients, have people with better blood pressure control.
I love it. Yeah, that's definitely been something that I've noticed over time. I think as new guidelines have come out and new reviews have come out, it looks like one of the main goals is to make it easier to screen people.
Well, we try to do that. I think a lot of the European investigators try to keep it complicated and make it think that it's an ivory tower thing. Yes, the physiology and the science is complicated, but the clinical practice should not be. And so we'll go over that. And the other thing I want to emphasize, and we'll probably shift gears and talk about Cushing's next, and it's the same thing is true there. Well, there's a subclinical hyperthyroidism and there's a asymptomatic hyperparathyroidism. There has to be mild forms of these other endocrine diseases. And of course there are. And I'm going to also review the data from the Boston group about the preclinical primary aldo, the occult primary aldosteronism. And it's probably even more common than we're even saying 8%. But again, does it matter? What do you need to do about it? How far do you need to go with the evaluation? In addition, the current assays that we use for aldosterone and other steroids are largely mass spectrometry based. And you know what? The numbers are a little bit lower than we get with the old assays. So we don't have crisp cutoffs. It's a continuum with low renin hypertension. And so again, the decision tree is first, how likely are they to have a tumor? How much will they benefit from surgery? Or should I just treat them medically? But I don't want people to be dissuaded from screening because of the complicated stuff that comes next if you're going to go all the way to surgery.
It's certainly come a long way since Jerome Kahn described it, I think, at Michigan.
At Michigan, and that was about 70 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. So you mentioned Cushing syndrome. So another condition that's associated with hypertension and obesity. Same kind of question. When should we be screening people for Cushing's?
Right. So the problem with Cushing's is twofold. One is that we have a lot of overlap in the screening tests with normal range, a lot of causes for false positive, depression, alcohol use, renal insufficiency, things like that. So we don't have crisp cutoffs in Cushing's either. And the second problem is that unlike primary aldosteronism, we don't have widely available, safe, cheap medicines to use to treat this directly. So the stakes are a little bit higher when we embark upon that workup. A lot of the literature, from what we know now, is that even mild Cushing's does have long-term morbidities, but they are long-term morbidities. They take 10 to 20 years to develop. They don't develop in a week or two. It's not like a patient coming in with a potassium of 2 and the ectopic ACTH syndrome, who, if you don't do something in the next week, they will probably be dead. That's an emergency. But these other ones, we have some time to evaluate them. So again, I think the literature is a little clouded because most of what we know is in people who have presented with an incidental adrenal tumor. So then you have a smoking gun. So this is a population who is already enriched in having hypercortisolism. So if you don't know that, then who do you screen? So what I usually tell people is, first of all, the physical exam is the most important thing. And I'll go over, well, actually, I won't be going, but probably in the deep dive, we'll be going over some of the specific features of Cushing's. So if people have unexplained skin thinning, unexplained osteoporosis, muscle weakness, those are important things. Obesity by itself, if that's the reason the patient is coming to you, is actually a negative predictive factor for having Cushing's. But you should think about it when people don't respond to the usual medicines. There is a change in their trajectory. They had been well controlled for 5 years, and then all of a sudden they're not. So I think these are the things that should make you always think about this. But it is a much tougher issue in trying to decide about who to screen, because in that case, again, you can't just treat medically most of the time.
How does the presence of diabetes change things?
It is another factor that makes the stakes higher. So just having diabetes, not necessarily a predictive factor, but an unusual trajectory, a change in their diabetes management, a failure to respond to the usual medications, that I think is one of the things that you should think of. So when we talk about complex diabetes, people who are on a lot of medicines who have comorbidities from it, it is an enriched population for Cushing's. But again, I think you should think about how they got, not just where they are today, but how they got there. So I have, you know, diagnosed Cushing's in a number of patients who were being followed for 5, 10 years, always on the same treatment, always doing well. And then now they're not doing so well. The usual adjustments aren't working. And then they have some other things going on. Like in addition, their hypertension has gotten worse or their bone density has gotten worse. So there's a couple of things going on that lead you into that diagnosis. So I think this is one of the most difficult problems in all of medicine, is trying to pick up Cushing's in its earliest forms when you don't already have an imaging finding that's pointing you to that diagnosis.
And the folks that do have an incidentally found adrenal mass or an adrenal nodule, which is fairly common, maybe talk a little bit about adrenal steroid profiling, because I know that's a lot of work that you've done.
Right. So two things. One is that primary aldotumors can be any size. And many times we see a tumor on the CT scan. And when we do the adrenal vein sampling, it's actually not that tumor that's causing the aldosteronism. But yet cortisol-producing tumors tend to be at least 2.5 to 3 centimeters. So for cortisol, size matters. The bigger the tumor, the bigger your index of suspicion, the higher your index of suspicion, and the more likely I'm going to do more thorough workup and maybe follow-up testing in that person, even if the first set of tests are within the normal range. So that's point one. Now, point two is if you have one of those larger tumors and you're concerned about adrenal cancer versus adenoma, we have learned a lot from the Urinact group, that the European study of adrenal tumors, the NSAT, where they've looked at urine steroid metabolites. And we've done some work in our group with Gary Hammer and Toby Else for comparing adrenal cancers to benign adenomas. And the results from the two groups are concordant. Adrenal cancers, and the older endocrinologists know this, that they tend to make not just one hormone. They tend to make a couple of things. The other thing we learned is that they tend to make precursors. So of all the steroids that you could measure, the one that's most commonly elevated in adrenal cancer is 11-deoxycortisol. So these tumors tend to be relatively 11-hydroxylase deficient. So they still may have Cushing's, but often their 11-deoxycortisol is even higher than their cortisol. And if they don't have Cushing's, they may have an elevated 11-deoxycortisol. And it's important to do this testing ahead of time to know if the tumor is making these precursors, because then you have a biomarker. Then you can follow people without CT scans for recurrence, because you know what they're making. So there is some progress with that. And there are some simple tests that you can do now that are currently available. You don't have to do the whole profile. You can do some targeted testing. If you get a progesterone and 11-deoxycortisol, that will pick up most people with an adrenal cancer. So that's useful to know. The last thing that we've learned is that primary aldotumors tend to also make cortisol. And because of that, they tend to also make these hybrid steroids that have, for example, 18-hydroxycortisol that we used to think were unique to glucocorticoid remediable aldosteronism. No, people with aldosterone producing adenomas also make these things. So we're moving towards better diagnosis of aldosterone producing adenomas by measuring these oddball steroids at the same time as we're measuring renin and aldosterone. So that should be ready for prime time in the near future. But I want people to be thinking about this, that the adenomas are not really phenocopies of the zona glomerulosa or zona reticulata. They're a little different, and the cancers are definitely different, and they have unique properties. And so take advantage of that when you're doing your workup to characterize what these tumors are making in case you need to follow these people over time for recurrence.
Excellent. The last question I wanted to ask you pertains to people with congenital adrenal hyperplasia. What can we do to help with the transition period when folks are maybe followed by their pediatrician and their pediatric endocrinologist into the adult world? Because I feel like I don't see as many people with CAH as I thought I might in clinical practice.
Right. So there is information emerging that a lot of these people are not getting taken care of. They're not getting seen by endocrinologists. They're getting their scripts renewed by their primary care doctor or so on. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, the adult with congenital adrenal hyperplasia is kind of a new disease. I mean, these people didn't stay alive until cortisone became widely available in the 1960s and 70s. So it's only been in the last 20 or 30 years that the children that are being born and who are being identified by newborn screening are reaching adulthood. Second, a lot of adult endocrinologists were not trained to take care of adults. They may have seen a few children with CAH in the pediatric rotation, but they never saw an adult with CAH. So we're learning more. We're getting better at identifying the parameters that are necessary for care, but our toolbox is not up to snuff. what you find is that a lot of people are either overtreated or undertreated. They're undertreated that their cortisol is adequately replaced, but their androgens are high, or they're overtreated and they're cushionoid, but their androgens are normal. And that's because, again, with the current armamentarium that we have, it's very difficult to thread that needle into adulthood and get people adequately replaced and adequately controlled. So one of the things I'll talk about is some of the drugs that are in trials now that we and others are doing that should simplify care. I think transitioning of children to adult care overall in the United States is not very good. I mean, just think about your type 1 diabetes patients, right? I mean, do they smoothly come to you? There's a few reasons for that. One is that most of the children are being taken care of at children's hospitals, and the adult endocrinologists are not at the children's hospital. So the referring physician, the pediatric endocrinologist, will pull up a phone book and come up with some names, but they don't really know who's skilled or not. So talk to your colleagues in pediatric endocrinology. Let them know that you're comfortable taking care of these patients. And, you know, there's a number of new reviews that we and others have written to guide people on this. The guidelines have been updated a few years ago, but there's a few good review articles on this now and new treatments coming. So I think the day will be a better day for these patients in the future. But I think if you're willing to take on these patients, you really got to tell your pediatric endocrinology colleagues, because they really don't know who to send them to.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I really enjoy about endocrinology is that communication, the multidisciplinary nature between primary care and pediatric endocrine care and myself as an adult endocrinologist. Well, Dr. August, this was great. I know we are very excited about your sessions at the meeting, and thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, thank you, David. I'm looking forward to seeing you all in Seattle in a few weeks.
Excellent. Thank you. I'd like to thank Dr. Pierce, Dr. Hirsch, and Dr. August for their time and for talking to me today during our ACE podcast. And I look forward to seeing everybody in Seattle, May 4th through the 6th. I will see you there.
Thanks for listening to another great ACE podcast. Join us for another episode at aace.com/podcasts and help us in our mission to elevate clinical endocrinology. Together, we are ACE.